Good evening, everybody. We're going to call the Subcommittee on Local Government meeting to order. We do have a quorum. And is there someone that is ready to move approval of the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Elkins will move that. All those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, minutes stand approved as read. Thank you. We're going to do our calendar or agenda a little bit differently. First, we're going to go with Representative Kunesh-Pradeen, then Representative Lee, and last we'll do Representative Elkins. And if Representative Kunesh-Pradeen would go to the front, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, do you want me to move your bill for you?
Would you please?
Okay. I am going to move House File 1513. Please proceed.
Thank you. This is a pretty simple bill, and it's an outdated bill. The last time that this was updated or funded was in 1961. So I don't know how many of you were around in 1961. I was, but it's been a while. So this bill affects only 107 charter cities in Minnesota. And of the 853 cities in Minnesota, most of them are statutory cities and are organized according to state statutes. But the charter cities are organized by a city charter, like it's sort of like a mini constitution. And although they too are obliged to follow many of the state laws regarding statutory cities, they operate just a little bit differently. And basically what we are asking for tonight, the Charter Commission is given by state law access to the city funds needed to inform the voters in a neutral fashion of proposal amendments to their charter. However, the amount listed in the statute is a fixed amount, and as I said, it was established back in 1961. So currently the maximum amount in a year for a first-class city, such as Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Rochester, is $10,000 that they can use to inform through postcards or letters or that sort of thing, any changes to the charter. And they have up to $10,000. But for other charter cities, such as Columbia Heights in my district, it's $1,500. And that's hardly enough to print and mail out any kind of information that they want to share. So $1,500 is a ridiculously insufficient amount for getting any written information out to voters. This bill doesn't even bring it up to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index equivalent, but it sets an amount that is aligned with the city's current certified general property tax levy. So this would allow the city to make accessible to their charter commission the greater amount of 0.0007 of the city's certified general property tax levy, or $1,500, but no more than $20,000 in a year. And so this bill basically would allow the commission to fund any printed and posted information to household, even just one mailing with the pros and cons of a proposed amendment. And so I would ask you this evening to please support this updating of the statutes from 1961 to allow for the efficient functioning of our charter commission or the 100 or so charter cities in Minnesota.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to address this issue? Not seeing any, I will move House File 1513. It will be going back to government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion passes. Thank you so very much.
Thank
and
you.
Have a good evening. Next, we will do House File 3060. Representative Lee, if you will come to the table and identify yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 3060.
Oh, okay. That's right, you do have an amendment. I will move your amendment as soon as I find it. I apologize. Okay.
What?
Okay, I will move amendment A1 so that you'll have it in the... Oh, I'm sorry. I would like to move your bill first, and then we will take up the amendment A1 so you'll have it in the order that you like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You now have your bill as you would like. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House file 3060 as amended. It is a bill about keeping families together and for us to say that profiting from detention and imprisonment of immigrants and communities of color is never okay. It is about respecting the humanity and the basic rights of every person. It is about standing against policies that generate fears and criminalize immigrant communities and communities of color. The bill, as amended, prohibits the Department of Corrections and local units of government from contracting with the federal government or an entity operating under contract with the federal government to house persons accused of a civil violation of federal immigration law. The bill also avoids existing contracts. Madam Chair, this bill is needed because we have seen in Minnesota and other states that human rights violations occur and there are barriers to assessing legal representation for people detained by ICE. For example, in Sherburne County, they make no special provisions for the ICE population. One, despite several jail expansions, they have never built outdoor recreation space so that people in ICE custody can get outdoors. Two, they refuse to permit a visitation program. Three, there is no special staff training or treatment for torture and trauma survivors. And four, access to legal counsel is limited, and policies relating to access for law students and interpreters is constantly changing. The state of Minnesota cannot continue to let this happen for our immigrant communities and communities of color. We need to respect the humanity and basic rights of everyone, Madam Chair, and I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Please do so.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Nicole Richards. I'm from Zimmerman, Minnesota in Sherburne County, and I've been a resident there for roughly 7 years. I am here today representing SARI, Sanctuary and Resistance to Injustice, from Union Congregational Church, United Church of Christ in Elk River, and from the Sanctuary State Coalition. SARI is a unified interfaith and grassroots community coalition based in Sherburne County, and partnered with several other allied groups who together represent more than 1 million members statewide. We advocate for immigration detainees at the Sherburne County Jail, and we have heard and witnessed countless stories from immigrants and their families regarding the mistreatment and the inhumane practices that have been going on at the Sherburne County Jail. We strongly oppose this against our brothers and sisters what is occurring there. The inability and lack of fresh air, the inedible food, and the undrinkable water, the forced psychotropic medications, the inability for them to have medical and psychiatric care, the lack of fresh air, the forced administration, like I said, and the punitive use of solitary confinement, to name a few. We strongly oppose that the county's desire to expand the jail happen and to detain more immigrants and start an immigration court. We believe in treating all members of our community with dignity, respect, and compassion. We believe families are stronger and together that the diversity makes our communities healthier. We believe that all policies and practices that work with immigrants and refugees should represent these values. I would like to read to you a couple quotes from the Sherburne County Board regarding ICE expansion beds. The first was by Tim Dolan, Sherburne County Chair Board. We are in constant contact with ICE and U.S. Marshals as far as how we can renew and expand the contracts we currently have, and that's the route we'll continue to go until we have another avenue presented to us. The second is from the Sherburne County Board with respect to the RFP proposal. Sherburne County has proven that it puts any special requests at ICE at a high priority, and we will continue to do so in the future. In other words, the Sherburne County Board puts ICE's needs above residents' wishes. In fact, just yesterday, SARI's allies attended the Sherburne County Commissioner Board meeting. They provided heart-wrenching testimony about experiences about their undocumented family members and of what they went through in the jail. During this emotional, graphic testimony, some county board members laughed. As SARI members, we too have had similar dismissive responses when we have raised concern about detainee mistreatment. The challenges we face with inhumane and unjust immigration detention at the Sherburne County Jail are not isolated. You likely know of the unconstitutional detention practices at the Nobles County Jail, and there are dozens of other examples of immigration detention horror stories from around the country. SARI and the Sanctuary State Coalition are in support of HF 3060 with requesting two changes. The first is that we would like to strike the word civil in section 1, paragraph B, and that a paragraph C be added, which would read, quote, "The sheriff or jailer shall not notify ICE or transfer or release any person into ICE custody who is being held under paragraph B." In closing, I would like you to reach deep into your hearts and support this bill. We've seen this happen numerous times. We read about this constantly in the news, and we're really asking for your support in this. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we have the testifier repeat the changes that they would like to see in the bill? Okay. I didn't quite get it down fast enough.
I'm sorry. In section 1B.
And is this on the amendment or the original language?
This is on the original, yes.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Is that it?
Is it? Follow-up.
Okay, and that one, and then we would like the following language to be added.
That what line?
And this is at, we would like to add a paragraph C to that, to after 2B, so add 2C, to read as follows, "The sheriff or jailer shall not notify ICE or transfer or release any person into ICE custody who is being held under paragraph B."
Okay, at this point, the first one should be, that would be an easy one. The second one, we really should try to abide by the 24-hour rule.
So, Madam Chair, I will be working with the testifiers, and as we move along the committee process, to incorporate some of the changes that they want.
Okay. Sounds good. So we'll just be voting on this as is.
Wait. And Madam Chair, I guess if they... question for the author, the testifier, or staff. What would be the effect of the proposed amendment by the testifier? What are they intending to do?
Oh. Who are you directing that question to?
Either the author, the testifier, or staff.
So, Madam Chair, this is the first time that I have heard about the proposed amendment, and so I'll be working with them, like I said, as we move forward in the process.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Kosnick?
I'll continue the discussion, but if Representative Freiberg's next on the list,
okay.
Go ahead.
Representative Freiberg.
I guess with the exception of the author's amendment, which has met the 24-hour rule, I don't think we should be making changes. I think the 24-hour rule is put in place to prevent things from happening kind of on the fly. So, the author, Representative Lee, has said he's willing to work with them to see if their recommendations can be accommodated. So If that is something he ultimately decides he wants to do, I think it's something that can be considered in the next committee stop. So I don't think we should, it's your discretion, Madam Chair, but personally I don't think we should be amending it on the fly in violation of the 24-hour rule.
Okay. And to clarify, that's what the intent is. We'll just go ahead with the bill as is, and we will let the author deal with the issues for the next committee.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Posnick.
I would still like to have a better explanation of what the intent of that amendment is and the bill more broadly of how that affects what we're going to be.
So, Madam Chair, like I've mentioned before, this is the first time I've heard about the proposal, and so I'll be working with them. And if you would like to sit down and have that conversation too, I welcome you to join us for this conversation.
Follow up, Representative Kasnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it just looks like, you know, from my brief understanding of what we were looking at, is that we're handcuffing what the sheriffs and jailers will do and putting that in statute a little bit. Causes some concern here, and I think even though we're not bringing up that amendment, it's something that I think needs to be discussed of what they're intending to do, and so it gives me cause on the bill.
Okay, thank you. There is another testifier as well. Thank you, ma'am. Welcome, and please identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Romero, and I'm here on behalf of the Interfaith Coalition on Immigration. It's a Twin Cities-based grassroots community organization, and also on behalf of the Sanctuary State Coalition, which Nicole mentioned counts up about a million members statewide, largely faith-based organizations. I'd like to thank Representative Lee and the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. And to begin my comments, I'd simply like to start by asking the members of the committee whether you consider yourself a person of faith.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
I don't think it's permissible under Masons and for have testifiers or other members question our motives.
Okay.
So I would prefer that the
I assume you were just making
it was a rhetorical question. I certainly was not questioning anyone's motives. I was simply inviting committee members to look inside themselves and ask themselves whether they consider themselves a person of faith. Because if you do consider yourself a person of faith, no matter what faith you may claim to be a part of or to embrace, then you likely believe in the dignity of all humanity. And you also likely believe in just systems of immigration. Our experience in working with immigrants and their families across the state of Minnesota is that the immigration system, not only in the state of Minnesota and particularly the state of immigration detention in Minnesota, is both unjust and inhumane. On a daily basis, we work with families who tell us horror stories about their experiences in the five county jails that operate as immigrant detention centers in the state of Minnesota. And the reason that we hear these horror stories is because of our county jail's deepening relationship with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE is an unaccountable public agency. And the closer that a county and a county jail, the closer that their relationship is to ICE, the less accountable that that county and that county jail becomes to the public. This bill, in our view, goes a long way to helping keep our county elected officials and our county jails that operate in collaboration with ICE. It goes a long way to keeping our immigration detention on a more level playing ground, and it keeps public officials at the county level operating county jails more closely relational to the public to which they serve. We urge you to support this bill. We look forward to working with Representative Lee on ways to potentially strengthen or improve the language, and we urge you to support the bill as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very
much. Madam Chair, will we have questions for the author or just questions for the testifier?
I would say at this point, I would just let it to the testifier. There's one more person
okay,
to testify. Okay, that is dead. That's Samantha. Is a third person here as well?
Yes.
Good evening. If you'd identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Samantha Sanchez. I also want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak and also giving the bill an opportunity to present itself. So I'm here on behalf of my brother, who was not able to be here because of traumatic experiences he's experienced at this facility at Sherburn for exact reasons of what Nicole was saying. And I'm also here on behalf of myself and my own personal experience of what I've had to happen with this traumatic event. So. My brother was at Sherburn for about 6 to 5 months. He was previously at Albert Lee, and they transferred him over to Sherburn for supposedly getting more medical help because he did develop a mental illness, and he has schizophrenia, so that's why he was transferred over there. But it's been a nightmare trying to deal with Sherburn because, one, I've scheduled countless video visits for my brother to see if I could see him, to see if he was okay, because we weren't even notified that he was going to be transported from Albert Lee to Sherburn. So that was kind of scary, not knowing where my brother was for couple weeks. And getting there, I scheduled an appointment finally. It was my fourth time scheduling there, and it was just been a hassle. The visitation area for detainees is very seclusive. It's very hard to find, and people just make you go in a loop, and it was just very difficult to get there in the first place, and to get an appointment to see my brother was also very horrible because it's video visitation, and if you don't do it in person, you have to do it over yourself, and that it's also kind of expensive for the 12 minutes that I get to talk to my brother. If I get to talk to him, it's $22 plus tax, plus a dollar more per minute. I think that's kind of outrageous for me to try to see my brother was okay. And in the little bit that he has opened up about it, he felt that me and my mom forgot about him. So that was kind of hard on me and my brother. I'm sorry. So, and for him to tell me and my mom that he felt that we forgot about him because Sherburn has made it really hard to make video visitations with my brother, that made me mad and also very disappointed in our system. And we can better it. I know we can. And that's why I'm here today to let you know that we need to give this a go, because I can only imagine what the next family is going to feel like, or if it keeps on going. And we need to put a stop to this, because families are being separated every day. I didn't know if I was ever gonna see my brother again. And for those 7 months that he was away, I had forgotten what he sounded like just because I couldn't video visit him. So I wanna thank you for having me here and letting me speak on this behalf and for the personal experience, because I know it's more than just saying about or hearing about these stories. It's about living them and ending these stories so we don't hear them anymore.
Thank you for sharing with us. I know that's very difficult. Are there questions of the testifier? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for the author? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairwoman. See, regarding the testifier's brother who was incarcerated, I don't know why he was. I guess I can jump to a conclusion, but why was he treated that way by the Sherburne police, the Sherburne corrections officers? Doesn't a person that's in that condition have the same rights as anyone else?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't work for the Sherburne County Sheriff, so I cannot answer that question.
Representative McDonald, follow up?
No.
Okay.
Representative Shaw. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee, so this bill is to prohibit the detention of, is it detention of civil violations or criminal violations?
So, Madam Chair, this bill is for civil violations. And I do have someone here who's more able to talk about this in general. And so if, Michelle, you don't mind coming down just to talk about the differences between the two.
Welcome to our committee, and please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I am Deputy Director of the Advocates for Human Rights. Thank you for calling me up. If there are questions around the civil versus criminal distinction, I'm happy to address those. But in general, ICE holds people under the authority granted to it under our federal immigration laws for civil immigration violations. And there's also criminal statutes relating to immigration that has separate authority. This bill would not address that. It simply addresses those people who are in detention pending either a charge of removal or an attempt by the government to remove someone from the United States. Those are civil provisions, and the process of removal is a civil process.
Follow up? Okay. Representative Kosner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the House research on this, could the author talk about it? It says it voids any existing contracts. So this bill will usurp existing contracts between the jails, I guess, or the counties or other levels of government, and we're going to interfere in that. Is that my understanding?
So this bill will void the current five contracts that we have. And if I could just ask staff to talk about the contracting of Ms. Dyson so that members have a perspective of that piece of it.
Ms. Dyson, please.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, it does have a retroactive effect. And for any law to have a retroactive effect, you have to actually say so, otherwise it has prospective effect. It does raise a question of potentially being challenged as an impairment of a contract. There are arguments when a contract is impaired, it's not an absolute ruling that it's unconstitutional. There isn't an analysis, and it starts with the courts presuming that a law that has been enacted is presumed to be constitutional, and it requires beyond the reasonable doubt type proof for the court to find that, to find it unconstitutional. And the first thing that a court would look at is there a substantial impairment? If you're voiding the contract, that seems to be a substantial impairment. But then after that, you're looking at whether or not there's a significant and legitimate public purpose behind the law, and then are the court would be looking at the balancing of that public purpose and whether or not the means that are being used in the law to accomplish it are reasonably related and directly connected to that purpose. So the bottom line is that it could be challenged as unconstitutional, but it isn't an automatic ruling. There would be an analysis.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So a question for Ms. Dyson then. Just with what you said, would that be, if this would become law, then Minnesota would be in violation of federal law. Is that correct?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, I'm not sure what you mean by in violation of federal law. What are you referring to?
Well, in regards to immigration law.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, there would be a law that would be relating to the contracts, but there is no federal preemption that I'm aware of that tells the state how it relates to local governments. The state has the authority to tell local governments and its own agencies how to behave, and that's not preempted by federal law in this matter to the extent that I've heard. So really the issue is the retroactive effect and whether and presumably being challenged how that would be handled by the court.
Follow up, Representative McDonald.
This might be a question for staff, but we do have laws on the books that are retroactive as of now, right? In the past, we've had at least passed some laws that have retroactive effect.
I'm sorry, Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Zhang, I assume so, yes.
Yeah.
I can't point you to anything right now, but...
Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to a different part of this, if the author could talk about how this would affect the counties of Sherburne or the sounds like Pine City and perhaps Appleton, how it would affect the budgets of those entities or those sheriff's departments or counties.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have not spoken with the entities that you have mentioned, and those entities have not reached out to me expressing any concerns.
Representative Kosnick.
I don't know if we're getting close to wrapping it up here, I appreciate what the intent of the bill is, have some concerns with avoiding current contracts, and I certainly, I think goes to probably maybe what you're trying to bring up the issue of a broader discussion perhaps about the number of undocumented citizens that we have here living in Minnesota, or some would say not citizens, but I certainly am empathetic to the issues surrounding that you know, last I knew was about 90,000. I don't know if that's a number that you're familiar with, and so I appreciate where you're bringing the issue forward in this realm. Have some concerns with the way the bill does is written and what it intends to do in some of those areas I mentioned, but that's all.
Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize that what we're trying to do here is we have heard from the testimonies about some of these unjust and inhuman conditions that folks are going through when they're putting into this facilities. And so what we are doing right now is to end those practices here in the state of Minnesota and really say that we should not be profiting off the backs of immigrant communities and our communities of color who are in these detention facilities.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just seems like we're wrapping this up. I just want to say thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward. I think you are addressing a really critical issue of our time. As the state government, we do have the authority to tell local governments what their priorities should be. I think that's we need to exercise caution in that regard. I was a former city council member, so I feel generally strongly in favor of local government control. But here, there's no federal law that says we have to house civil detainees of immigration laws. And so there's no federal law being violated by your proposal. The test, as emphasized by Ms. Dyson, was just whether or not there's a legitimate and significant public purpose, and there really is here. We heard some really heart-wrenching stories. We hear about kids in cages down at the border. This is an area I think we need to show some leadership on. I really appreciate that you're doing that in this context, and I'm proud to support your bill.
Are there any other comments? Seeing none, I would like to add and thank Representative Lee for this for this bill. This is not the first time I've heard about the appalling situation that has taken place at that in Sherburne. And again, when the last time there were a number of people that had not heard about it before, and they were just struck that this is happening in our state. So again, thank you. We will proceed to take the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Okay. The House File 3060 passes, and it will be referred on to GovOps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
And then our last bill of the night would be Representative Elkins. Proceed when ready, Representative Elkins.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1095. And then we will have one simple amendment.
Okay, and is there an amendment for yours?
Mm-hmm. And this will go on to government operations.
Okay. Thank you. All those we will in favor of moving House File 1095, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And I'm assuming you want to move your the amendment as well.
Yes.
Okay, proceed, please.
The amendment is very simple. It just bill as originally filed had a July 1st, 2019 effective date, and we're just deleting that so that the bill would become effective on July 1st after and whatever year it's enacted.
August 1st.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. What?
August.
Oh, August 1st. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right.
And corrected.
All those that are in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The amendment is passed, and you are ready to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, and this is one that Ms. Finn and I have been working on for probably close to two decades. The first time I think appeared in this chair in this bill, I was a city council member in Bloomington. I think the first or second time it was heard. So we'll keep plugging away at this until we get it done. But basically what this does is it establishes a mechanism for a municipality to create a street improvement district, and then any of a variety of equitable consistent means, either market value, tax capacity, front footage, building area, or some combination above, create a fee to be used to collect to defray the cost of building street improvements within a district. So it's particularly relevant in cases where of a redeveloping city, for example, which is needs to upgrade its road system in response to the demands of redevelopment, but could be used more broadly than that as well. So the key problem that we're trying to address here is that the cities have become almost entirely dependent on property taxes to finance street improvements. And at this point, about 84% of the cost of municipal street improvements is being paid for with property taxes alone. Only the remainder is coming off of the municipal state aid allocation of the state gas tax. And with the gas tax essentially frozen for I don't know how many years it is now, we're actually in a situation in the state where the property taxes that we pay to cities and counties are actually the single largest source of funding for roads and bridges at all levels of government, even more than the state gas tax. And it just can't go on that the property tax continues to bear 100% or 84% of the cost of making necessary street improvements. So the opponents of the bill point out that cities do have other mechanisms in addition to the property tax. They just will propose why not use special assessments, but the special assessment process is extremely cumbersome, especially for a larger area. It works reasonably well if we're talking about repaving a block of a residential street, but for complex redevelopments in business areas, it's not really practical. Again, we've talked about state government aid. Cities get 9.2% of the gas tax revenues. They can only be used on the higher level state aid streets, collector and arterial roads. And again, they're only paying for about 15-16% of the total cost of roads. And most cities, in my neck of the woods at least, are spending almost all of their municipal state aid money just on their matching share of county projects and state projects. So there's virtually none left over from most cities just to do general street network improvements. Special service districts, I think tax increment financing, property tax abatement, there are cases where those are relevant and appropriate, but not in all cases. And then the last option they list is local option sales taxes, which I don't think are ever appropriate for road improvements, though I could spend a half an hour talking about why I think that's a bad idea. So just in general, I think this is a fair tool. It's a needed tool to help relieve cities, reliance solely on property taxes to make much needed improvements to the road district. So I have with me Ann Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I can't have forgotten Justin Justin from Wright, who's the Public Works Director from Elk River, Minnesota.
Okay, and who will be going first? If you would identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Sure, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to express the League's very strong support for this legislation. And I do apologize. We had Mayor Mary McCumber from Oak Park Heights signed up to testify on our behalf tonight, and she will not be able to be here. So I will make a couple of the points that she was planning to make and then give it over to Justin Femright. Some points that just to supplement some of the things you heard from Representative Elkins is that this bill really gives the cities that want to use this tool the ability to plan and manage their pavement responsibly. We know, and the city engineers have really drilled this into me, that this maintenance is essential. With a good maintenance schedule, pavement life can be prolonged to 50 to 60 years. Versus without it, where the pavement life is closer to 25 or 30 years. And for every $1 spent on maintenance, the road authority saves $7 in repairs. So if we can collect these fees up front and do the maintenance on schedule, it's really doing a better job with maintaining those assets. I want to address two issues that have been raised by the opponents of this bill, and the first is that this bill is not constitutional, and I want to just let you know that it is modeled after existing authority that cities have, the Sidewalk Improvement District Authority under Minnesota Statute 435.44, and that has been in effect since 1974, and this bill closely mirrors the language in that statute. And also the St. Paul case that has been referenced, the city in that situation had not established districts. They were collecting the fees citywide. And the other point is that this bill is unfair to tax-exempt property owners. And I want to draw your attention to Subdivision 10 of the bill, which exempts institutions of public charity. And that is connected to a definition that is also in statute in Chapter 272.02. And that would exempt some nonprofits that are doing really good work out there, operating many times with volunteers and with donations. And so while the bill would still apply to uses such as hospitals and universities, it would not apply to social service organizations and those that I mentioned. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of this testifier? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In discussing the Subdivision 10 institutions of public charity, would a public charity like the Mayo Clinic be included or excluded in this bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Ms. Kosnick, it would depend on where the city established the boundaries of the district. So I don't know in the case of the city of Rochester if they would intentionally put the Mayo Clinic in the district or not, depending on where their projects, where the needs are. But it's my understanding that if the city did put that hospital in the district, that they would be paying. I should note also that nonprofit or tax exempt properties also pay special assessments. So, you know, this is a way of maybe just doing it differently. We do have a provision in here that prohibits a local unit of government from using a special assessment tool and a street improvement fee for the same project. So, you know, it would be something that perhaps the city would want to negotiate with the property owner about which way they preferred to pay, because tax-exempt properties now do pay special assessments.
Follow-up?
I'm good.
Okay, thank you. And if the other testifier will proceed, identify yourself, please.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Justin Femright. I currently work for the City of Elk River as the Public Works Director and Chief Engineer. Here tonight representing the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, where I'm currently the elected president of that organization, and in support of the bill before you, House File 1095. You know, opponents of this bill will point to a long history of bipartisan opposition around this being bad policy. And really, I think we could just do a better job as cities to tell our story and why, you know, why a bill like this is so important to cities to deliver projects and deliver services to our residents. You know, the same folks who are opposing this really stand to benefit from this, because, you know, in their professional life and in their occupation, while they might oppose it, in their personal life, they still live in our cities. And as city representatives, we're here to deliver assets and deliver maintenance on these assets in the most fiscally responsible way for everyone. So all of you live in Minnesota, and I'm going to make an assumption that many of you live in cities. You know, most of you, your driveways touch a city street. I currently live in Elk River. My driveway is on Elgin Drive. It's a residential street. As Representative Elkins pointed to, you know, 84% of the streets that we maintain are residential streets in these cities. You know, Elgin Drive being a typical local residential city street, we really have two options for maintaining that street, and that's general property taxes and special assessments. It's not in a commercial or industrial area where special service districts would apply. We're not looking at global redevelopments of our neighborhoods in town, so tax increment financing and property tax abatements aren't really options for us. And it gets back to coming back to those two options that I talked about. And a lot of times in the cities of Minnesota, those two options, general property taxes and special assessments, are used in combination to split up the costs. So 25-30% may be done by a special assessment, where the remainder is made up by the general taxes. So it's really one solution that we have before us. And, you know, the idea of this continuing to come back isn't because it's poor policy. It's because it's a continual challenge and continual issue that stays with us for the likes of 20 plus years, as Representative Elkin has indicated they've been working on this. So we strongly support this. We feel that proposed legislation gives cities true options or alternatives to the general tax and special assessment methods. You know, the legislation as written provides for pavements and street infrastructure, which are consumable assets. They're consumable commodities. They degrade. We have to rebuild them to be treated more similar to our sidewalks and our sewer systems, our water systems, and collecting for that consumption on those. This legislation provides for more local control over how we can fund these local improvements. It also provides for funding option that a city can choose to explore. It doesn't put a have to. A city doesn't have to move to something like this, but it gives that option that a city could explore and add to the way they deliver projects. This legislation also is a necessary transition to meet the ever-changing demographics of the residents that we serve and what they task us with on a day-to-day basis. This legislation before you allows and is kind of our current day ability to innovate and our current day ability to adapt to that changing demographic. This legislation does not allow for cities to just globally put in a fee that is going to be long-lasting and forever there. This legislation further does not ask for outside funding to help cities tackle this challenge. This legislation does not prohibit a city from continuing practices that might be working for them. Different cities throughout the state have programs that suit them currently. Others are struggling. So it doesn't prohibit them or change how they have to do things. And ultimately, it doesn't allow any of these new fees to go in without due public process and due public hearings that are vital to all the decisions that you all make here and that we certainly make at the local level. So with that, I appreciate the time tonight, Madam Chair, and I stand to answer any questions.
Thank you. I would like to ask one of you to actually describe the special assessment process and the cost involved in that.
Yeah, I can touch on that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And members of the committee. The special assessment process, we follow Statute 429, which details specific requirements for public notice, public hearings to establish what is a project. And then we'll do that via formal report. We'll put together a report that ultimately must carry with it findings for the public purpose and findings for the need for the improvements. Within that, that report will detail how assessments and how a project is to be paid for via assessments. And it'll break it up in a quantifiable way, spread it out via front footage or an area assessment or by a unit calculation. And then in almost all cases today, maybe not 20 years ago, cities then have to defend that increase and defend that amount through private property appraisals to defend that there is a value to an increase of property value that equals that amount. Those assessments and those appraisals don't come for free. And ultimately, what we're seeing on projects that we take through the 429 process by the time we are done with the public hearings, the appraisals, and the added administrative costs to those, a fee of about a 20% increase on those projects. And when I talked earlier in my testimony about being able to deliver these projects in a more fiscally manner, we can save a lot of those costs up front. And that's not to do it in a way to be unfair or ram something through because we don't think their value will be there. It's really just doing it in a very transparent way and in the most fiscally responsible way we can. So I think I stepped through most of the process to get to your question, Madam Chair, but I can certainly elaborate more if you would like.
Okay, what I was trying to get at is like maybe if you get, well, the cost of what the appraisal, which doesn't help build the roads at all, so if you can give us an estimate of that, and then typically maybe give an example of what the appraisal cost might be, but then bottom line is what the city will actually be able to charge and hopefully avoid the litigation process.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's been some time since I've went through the 429 process personally. So I wish I had a more refined estimate for you on that appraised value. But ultimately, when these projects, or how much the appraisal itself costs, when the projects come through, they're really then limited to what does the appraisal say a property value is increased. If it says there is a $2,000 increase on a particular property, well, that's the limit that then can be assessed. And sometimes that value is lower than the statutorily required amount that we need to collect in revenue from special assessments to qualify for the bonding that we need to use to borrow for doing the improvement. So there's a whole host of challenges, bottom line, with it that we navigate as we go. I don't have refined estimates and numbers that I can share with the committee. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your response. Are there any questions of the testifiers that are up there right now? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question regarding the so on the surface, I thought this was perhaps a good tool to have as a former mayor in Delano and a council member, and yet another opportunity to collect some funds for much needed road repair. But there are efficient ways already in which to do assessments and property taxes. So I do have some concerns regarding the bill. I talked to our city administrator just yesterday and had some good points, and I think if I had my mayor's hat on, I would want my legislator, at the time it would be Tom Emmer, to support it. But there are some things in your bill, Representative Elkins, that concern me. For example, section 3.626 subdivision 8 that would allow a city to compound, unless I am corrected, and I certainly don't mind being corrected, the ability to compound the fee or tax, I call it a tax, on a property owner. So under that section, it allows the municipality to, it doesn't restrict them from imposing other measures on that property. So you establish a district, you improve that road, you have that tax on that business or family, the city or municipality has the authority through our state statute to impose yet another tax on that through via property tax. I see in there you did take away or negate the authority of them to assess them, but they certainly would have the authority to include that on a property tax and assess and the special district. Yeah. So I have some concerns on that. So what say you?
What I would say is that I certainly agree.
Representative Elkins.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Would agree that the it would not be appropriate, as the bill says, to compound it with assessments, but I think certainly you would want to be able to use a combination of financing that might include some property taxes. As the city engineer pointed out, most cities, when they are doing assessments for like residential developments, use a combination of, say, 20-25% for the assessment portion and the remainder for property taxes. So I think those kinds of similar sort of a combination of this fee plus property taxes, and probably in some cases even TIF could be a good combination of financing mechanisms for a project.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Elkins, as a former, you were mayor as well, or city council member?
A city council member for nine years in Bloomington.
So I would presume that you also would have that concern that those senior citizens or anyone that had a fixed income could get a double whammy if this bill should become legislation on that piece of property and any road improvement. Now, my cities in my district, Wright County, I have great faith in them, of course, so I don't think that they would hopefully use a double statutory opportunity to tax them twice on the road improvement, but you never know, and other cities, not mine. So as a former city council member, I'm sure you share those concerns, don't you?
Well, I compounding it with assessments would be, I don't think that would be appropriate, but combining it with tax increment financing property taxes, I do think that could be an appropriate mix in some cases.
So, Madam Chair, if I may continue. So, in speaking with my city administrator, part of the argument that he shared with me is that it would, if this should become law, you could lower property tax, because you're not, let's say you have a $2 million road project, That, of course, is a bond payment. You have a 20-year bond, $150,000 bond payments per year. That's distributed about all the residents in your community. But if you have this district, then theoretically you could lower that property tax because they're not paying for those bond payments. But in this bill, it wouldn't do that. So I'm not sold on that. Well, and I think we should at least be concerned that we're not allowing a city to double tax a property for a street improvement project.
Representative Elkins.
Well, I certainly would agree with your city administrator that this tool would allow cities to reduce their overall property tax burden.
Representative, Madam Chairman, Madam Chair.
McDonough.
Yeah, Representative Elkins, yes, that's what that's we hope that would happen, but yep. Under this bill, they wouldn't have any, they wouldn't have the, it wouldn't restrict them from doing that. Yep. That's the concern.
Madam Chair, I mean, the main reason why cities are so interested in this bill is to provide property tax relief.
Follow up, Representative McDonough.
Then Representative Elkins, maybe we could work offline then to, under that subsection 8, to restrict them from a double tax, from increasing, putting that on the property tax roll.
Yeah, I'd be
Representative
open, Madam Chair, thank you. I'd be open to discussing that with you between here and GovOps.
Okay, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Mason. Representative Elkins, how do you think a city council member or mayor who doubled the residents' taxes would do in their next city election after doing that?
Yeah, not very well. I mean, just going through
Elkins.
The assessment process, Madam Chair, is rough enough on residential streets. That's one of a city council member's least favorite things to do is sit through assessment hearings.
Representative.
Yeah, just to follow it up with a comment. There is an accountability mechanism in here. It's called the elections. I mean, we have election certificates as well. Theoretically, we could double income taxes in the state, and I imagine we, you know, probably would not fare very well in the election. I mean, this addresses what I see as a really important need. I mean, you know, I was on the city council of a city that was largely developed after World War II. And just upkeeping the roads, it was just a huge undertaking, and trying to figure out a way to do that. We have a street improvement plan in Golden Valley where all the streets, you know, there's a map that's color-coded by which neighborhoods are getting their streets done, and just, you know, preparing for the debt service for that project is just a huge undertaking. So, I mean, it really makes sense to me that cities would be able to actually provide some property tax relief if they are able to put a mechanism like this in place, because just that was such a huge part of our budget on this when I was on the city council anyway. But so thank you.
Thank you.
Response?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Madam. Yeah. Okay. I agree 100%.
I guess I know there's a number of people that want to testify against, but are there any people in the audience that want to testify for the bill right now? Okay, and if you would approach the desk. Welcome, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Huser, and I represent Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents the shared interests of cities in the 7-county metro area. Metro Cities would like to express its support of Representative Elkins' Bill House File 1095 and thank him for carrying this legislation. Metro Cities policy supports the authority of cities to establish street improvement districts. The main sources of funding for maintaining street infrastructure are currently limited to MSA funding for cities over 5,000 in population, property taxes, and special assessments, as you've heard. Maintenance needs on street infrastructure are continuing to significantly increase. Street improvement districts provide an additional and important local tool that cities of all sizes may use to address local street maintenance needs. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions of the testifier, Representative Kosnick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Huser, you had appropriately mentioned the options that cities have right now to pay for some of this infrastructure cost. How have they managed over the last 20 years that this bill has been trying to resurrect itself? How have cities managed it?
Thank you for the question, Representative.
Mr. Hauser.
I would say that you know, cities have kind of almost been a victim of their own success. I mean, you're right, they have managed, but it is becoming more difficult. The maintenance challenges on street infrastructure are becoming larger. A lot of the infrastructure that was built 30, 40 years ago is becoming more infirm, more brittle, and the current tools that cities have been using are not going as far as they used to. So I think that while they have been successful up until this point, I think it is becoming to the point where cities are concerned that maybe they will not be able to maintain the infrastructure in the way that they know it needs to be maintained.
Follow up.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just submit, thank you, Madam Chair. I would, you know, maybe submit that as cities look at what their priorities are and what their main charge is to do, cities are quite up there at the top of their responsibility. So I think they've done an appropriate job of maintaining it thus far and with the tools that they have. So I'm almost wondering if we're looking, this is a solution that's been evasive, but a solution looking for more of a problem.
Thank you. The next person I have is Ethan Roberts. And we have an additional testifier. If you please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. My name is Amber Backus. I'm with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, and I was going to sort of tee it up for Ethan, if that's okay. Thank you very much for this opportunity. As folks have alluded to, this is an issue that has been around for over the last two decades, and I'd like to call this bill the Great Uniter, because it has brought together a diverse group of stakeholders opposed to the bill over the years, and this year is no exception. The list of opponents has grown and includes 27 statewide organizations and counting, and it really is a diverse group of folks, from the private sector to the nonprofit sector, hospitals to higher education, trucking companies to boat manufacturers, churches and synagogues, and lots of Main Street businesses. And we all could have signed up to testify, but we thought we'd be respectful of your time and spare you that, because it's getting late in the evening. So I'm here to represent the group's broad concerns about this bill, and then Mr. Roberts will speak specifically to its constitutionality. But we do respectfully disagree with the proponents of the bill that this would provide a fair and transparent way to fund municipal transportation projects. We believe it's the opposite. This bill grants cities the broad authority to draw the districts however they want, and there's no requirement that the property owners benefit from the transportation improvements. Districts could be gerrymandered to include commercial and industrial properties in order to spare residential properties from paying the fees, or they could be drawn to capture revenues from nonprofit entities like hospitals and religious institutions that are exempt from property taxes. And we think it would be much more politically palatable for cities to pursue these options instead of raising property taxes or pursue special assessments on homeowners. So to Representative Freiberger's point, we do think there is some re-election. This helps city council people get re-elected to the detriment of the local businesses and the nonprofit entities that are located in the jurisdiction. We also think the menu for determining the fees is expansive and opaque. As Representative Elkin said, cities could base them on market value, tax capacity, front footage, lot or building size, or any combination of these items. A small, low-value building on a large corner lot could face excessive fees if front footage is used to calculate what they owe. We don't think this is fair, and it's not that far-fetched of an example. St. Paul's experiment with these fees found the owner of a one-chair hair salon paying $1,200 in street fees on a small building she bought out of foreclosure for $35,000 because the fee was calculated on front footage. This amount was almost as much as the total she paid in property taxes to her city, county, and school district. That's a significant expense. And additionally, the bill allows cities to levy the fee up to 20 years, regardless of whether the street improvements have been paid off before then. We think these new fees put businesses that are assessed to them at a significant competitive disadvantage. Imagine if you're the owner of a small convenience store in a city and you are assessed this fee while your competitor down the street is not. If you operate on small margins and have to pass those costs along to your business while your competitor, you know, located a couple blocks away doesn't, that's a significant competitive issue. Meanwhile, many brick and mortar businesses are competing with online retailers. How fair is it that they are going to be charged these new fees on top of their property taxes while the online company that generates traffic on local roads to deliver their product is not? Again, we think it's not fair to the businesses that have chosen to locate in these communities and are paying property taxes. We do understand and recognize the struggle cities are having to keep up with burgeoning costs of transportation projects, but we talked about they have other funding mechanisms at their disposal. And we don't think the addition of a new property tax, because that's kind of what this is, you're going back to the same people to pay this. You're not calling it a property tax, but it's a new tax on property owners. We don't think it's justified. If the cities have a story to tell about their need for transportation improvements, as the previous testifier talked about, and they can justify that, I don't see why they can't do that through the property tax process versus creating a new mechanism that could be a little bit arbitrary and unfair and putting that on top of property taxpayers. As we said, this bill has been around for a long time. Since 2015, when it was last heard, cities have seen three increases in their local government aid, and they've been granted greater opportunity to use local option sales taxes. And I know Rep. Elkins is not a fan, but just last year, the legislature passed three local option sales taxes to fund transportation improvements for cities. So it is something that they are taking advantage of. And lastly, the other major development is that since then, the Minnesota Supreme Court has found these fees to be unconstitutional. And I know Ms. Finn had an opinion about that, but I would like to turn it over to Ethan Roberts, who can speak more eloquently to that. So.
Hi.
Good evening.
I'm Ethan Roberts, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, which means I'm a generalist. Okay, so at JCRC, we deal with everything from community security. Sometimes I'm in education committee, and I'm dealing with, you know, early childhood education. And now it's street improvement fees, and this is something which I've testified on in the past, several years ago, and I think the debate's better. I think this is good that we are not trying to argue that we're not, that these are fees and not taxes. I think we all recognize that this is an alternative to the property tax system, and I think the debate, the conversation benefits from that. So all the cases I found where, you know, the courts have ruled it doesn't matter what you call it, it is what it is, like, we can just skip past that because this is essentially a tax. And I get it. In a couple years ago, when this was in the Senate, I remember that there were testifiers who were talking about all of the tax-exempt properties in this mayor's city, and I can't remember exactly which city it was. And it's not surprising that St. Paul, was before the Supreme Court with its ROWs or whatever, however they pronounce that acronym, for, because they have in the city that we're in a lot of tax-exempt property. And it's a challenge. And if this was a debate on whether this is good public policy or not, you know, I may or may not agree with the proponents of this bill. I don't really think that matters. I think what matters is whether the bill, as drafted, is constitutional, whether it meets the obligations we have under Minnesota statutes. So Article 10 of our state's constitution is very explicit that the power to levy taxes on certain categories of property is not allowed. And then this is further developed in a subdivision, a section rather, 272.02. And it's important when you look at that to see that it takes what the state constitution mashed into one paragraph and it delineates it subdivision by subdivision. And so we acknowledge that under Representative Elkins' bill, subdivision 7, institutions of public charity, and it's a very complicated analysis, which I was involved with back in 2007, what is an institution of public charity, those are not in this bill. Okay, I was going to say they're exempted from the bill, but that gets confusing because we're talking about tax-exempt properties, so we shouldn't keep using the word exempt, but they're not in the bill. But what is still in the bill is everything else, so church property, houses of worship, so synagogues, educational institutions, arguably, public hospitals, schoolhouses, et cetera, et cetera. And so the question is, can we essentially levy taxes on these properties given the prohibition in the state's constitution and in statute? Now, it was mentioned earlier, and very accurately, that there is the authority to levy special assessments. This is something which is acknowledged and made very clear, actually, in the Minnesota Property Tax Administrator's Manual. I read it. It's really boring, but important. Module 5, and so just look to Module 5, which talks about, unless specifically stated statute, if a property exempt from property tax, it is still subject to special assessments. And this has been true since at least the 1950s, and in this 2016 opinion, it cites cases from the 60s, and fair enough. And the reason for this is that under a special assessment, there is a requirement that the taxing authority, the municipality, it must prove that there is a special benefit on the property. And so, the actual language is special assessments are valid only if they're imposed in an amount that does not exceed the special benefit. So the special benefit conferred on the assessed property by the improvement. The amount of the special benefit is determined by the increase in the market value of the property attributable to the improvement. So in other words, if you were to pave the streets in front of a church on Uptown of gold, that would make the church, I guess, more valuable, then yes, you could levy that. But under this regime, with a street improvement fee district, you're basically collecting money. I mean, let's look at Uptown. Temple Israel, your synagogue is located in Uptown. There are quite a few churches there. You could draw a special a district that would include those institutions. But all of the work could potentially be done blocks, a mile, 2 miles away. And there would be no benefit, certainly no special benefit, conferred onto the onto those institutions. And so it would not meet the standard of what is a special assessment. Now, it was raised earlier that there's this sidewalk improvement fee districts. Now, again, as I said earlier, I'm a generalist. I was not, very familiar with that. I will note that that never comes up in the Supreme Court decision that Judge Lohag issued in 2016 involving the city of St. Paul and the church. I think that would have been a good time to talk about this other option. It's not mentioned in Module 5. Maybe it's been litigated and I just couldn't find the case, and if it is, I will want to look at it, and just if this bill moves forward, which I hope it doesn't, we can discuss how it's more or similar. It does sound it's very limited to sidewalks. This is much broader. It has like 20 categories of things that could be included in it. But my sense is that if it were to be litigated, either the sidewalk improvement fees or this, most likely the courts would they would look to the 2016 opinion, they would look to other precedents, they'd look to the plain language of the state's constitution and say, to the extent that you are including these other tax-exempt properties, this is not allowable. And it's really, I was saying to Representative Elkins, who's a friend, this is definitely not personal, and I feel badly, because like all the other people in the bill are friends who I've worked with, but I do think that, before we pass something which is then potentially going to take up a lot of time for the Attorney General defending, laws passed by this legislature, a lot of time. We should really look carefully to see if this is going beyond what our Constitution, what our statutes allow. I don't think it does. Again, if this League of Cities has some Supreme Court opinion I haven't seen about how street, sidewalk improvements can be somehow go outside of the assessment process and apply to tax-exempt properties, I'd love to see it. I don't know why it wasn't mentioned in the 2016 case, but as far as I understand it, based upon what I've seen, this just seems clearly unconstitutional, and I think that's a problem.
Are there any questions so far? Thank you very much. And is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify? Okay, I am not seeing anyone. I did want to mention that there in our packet there is a letter from Rochester, and Mayor Kim Norton was in the building today encouraging support of the bill. And seeing since there... There are no questions.
Madam Chair?
No. Oh, Representative Kosnick.
I do have a question for the author, and I appreciate the effort that's being put forward. Can you explain to us how the districts would be drawn?
The bill does not, Madam Chair, sorry.
Representative Elkins.
Does not specify that. I think that's a good question, actually.
follow-up Representative Kosnick.
I appreciate the answer, and I guess, you know, what I'm hearing the testimony here is that they are very arbitrary, and that's concerning, as was previously mentioned, and so along with the other concerns, I will not be supporting this bill.
Response? In that case, Representative.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just in regards to subsection 10, subdivision 10, the institution of public charity, it does seem to be ambiguous. No, I understand it's part of section 272, subdivision 7, but it does lean towards interpretation that houses of worship, your nonprofit groups, 501c3s, maybe even 501c4s, could be subject to the district. Unless I could be have that clarified by Ms. Dyson or the author, if that does open the door and has a little bit of ambiguity for interpretation, misinterpretation.
Okay. Ms. Dyson, or did the author want to take it?
Madam Chair, I actually do have a copy of that that statute, and I'll read the definition. Institutions of purely public charity that are exempt from federal income taxation under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code are exempt if they meet the requirements of this subdivision. In determining whether real property is exempt under the subdivision, the following factors must be considered. And I don't want to read the whole thing. Basically, it says whether the stated purposes of the undertaking is to be helpful to others without immediate expectation of material reward, whether the institution of public charity is supported by material donations, gifts, or government grants for services to the public in whole or part, whether a material number of the recipients of the charity receive benefits or services at reduced or no cost, or whether the organization provides services to the public that alleviate burdens or responsibilities that would otherwise be borne by government, whether the income received, including material gifts and donations, produces a profit to the charitable institution that is not distributed to private interests. Five, whether the beneficiaries of the charity are restricted or unrestricted, and if restricted, whether the class of persons to whom the charity is made available is one having a reasonable relationship to the charitable objectives, and whether dividends in form or substance or assets upon dissolution are not available to private interests.
Thorough answer. Response?
No, well, just a little bit. That's a lot, of course, to read and to understand, or at least we'll have to look at that more closely. And I do understand it. It just is a little bit ambiguous, the public charity, even established by Subdivision 7. VFWs, Legion Halls could be subject to that taxing district as well, in addition to houses of worship. So that is a concern. I know that Ms. Finn said that wouldn't be the case, but as the other testifier illustrate, it is open to interpretation and therefore could be part of a property tax or fee if this becomes law. So I probably won't be able to support that this time as well. And I'd like to ask for a roll call, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Elkins, did you want to respond?
No, I think I'm ready to, if there are no other comments or questions, to, move that we advance House File 1095 as amended back to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And we will be doing a roll call.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Hertaus? Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Lean?
Aye.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Zhang? Chair Mason?
Yes. It is, what is that? Okay. The vote is 4-2, so the bill will be progressing to government operations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. And that concludes today's meeting. Thank you so very much for coming tonight. Have a safe trip home. Oh, we are adjourned.